Lil, put aside the ego and embrace the moment.
It's time for another midweek drive transcontinental adventure.
When you're a member of the Imaginative Fiction Writers Association, you're a member of the International Thrillers Writers Association and the Horror Writers Association, you are clearly heading towards becoming a Renaissance individual. And when you're American-Canadian as well, clearly it just adds to that joy as well. And when we start talking about such texts as The Haunting of Hill House, The Children of Red Peak, and more exciting things, we can only be referring to that awesome American-Canadian author, writer of speculative fiction, it's Craig DeLuey. How are you, Craig?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Really good to connect with your good self. Now, we've had a look, obviously, at the excitement that next week will be forthcoming, because literally it's only a matter of days now before November the 17th, 2020 arrives, and The Children of Red Peak is released.
Yes. I'm extremely excited about it. This is a big release for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the one liner we've got so far is the survivors of a doomsday cult's horrific last days reunite to confront their past and the entity that appeared on the final night. And there was I thinking that we'd actually ended all of Donald Trump's presidency in one fell swoop, but no. It's re-emerging. Yes.
Yeah, that's a nightmare that's going to keep on giving.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it works through that. Now, again, it examines belief, madness, and trauma in a psychological and supernatural horror novel. I mean, it does sound as though it's ideal for the oncoming cold winter's nights, really, Craig.
Yeah, I think that people will have a lot of fun with it. It's a psychological and cosmic horror story. Thematically challenging. It's about faith, family, fine line between belief and delusion. Delusion ultimately proves dangerous.
You could be describing the Brexit situation. No, I won't mention any more political jokes at all, because that's enough already. Jessica, you've had a chance to have a look at some of the biography of Craig. Any thoughts that you'd like to add at this stage?
Yeah, I'm curious. Did you grow up reading horror and thrillers, and made you want to write something the same genre, or...
Well, I grew up reading fantasy. I was in high school. I grew up in a rural area in New Jersey and was always craving escape. So I ended up discovering Robert E. Howard at a very young age, and he wrote this wonderful, very pulpy, weird tales kind of fiction, Conan, you know, all that stuff. And I found it a wonderful escape, and ended up falling into horror because I wanted to, what I was reading and finding so wonderful as an escape, I wanted to write. And when I started writing, I discovered a lot of different genres, all of it speculative fiction. It eventually brought me to horror by way of zombies. I wrote a zombie novel that ended up doing very well. And, you know, one thing ends up leading to another in this business. And so I ended up discovering horror and have had a ton of fun, you know, writing as well as reading it.
There's clearly got to be a situation where you could actually have Conan encountering the zombies. I mean, it's by Crom's blood, surely. I mean, it's a bit large there.
Some foul magic.
Yeah, he could team up with Red Sonja. There could be all sorts of things there. Amazing.
It's probably the one thing that hasn't been done yet, because zombies have been fully exploited, I think.
Well, until they've gone face to face with Conan the Barbarian, then clearly, you know. I mean, I've got to ask the question, Craig, more of an Arnold Schwarzenegger Conan the Barbarian fan or a latter incarnation, as the case of it's not been done as yet, the ideal interpretation of Conan?
Oh, yeah, hard to say. Probably now that I'm older, I do actually appreciate Arnold Schwarzenegger, but actually at the time I was a bit heartbroken when it came out. I was so excited because it wasn't like the books, you know, and I wanted it to be just like the books. But now that I'm older and I look back on Arnold Schwarzenegger playing that role, I have a bit of a nostalgia for it.
I like to feel it paved the way for him becoming governor of California. Maybe that's just me, you know? I mean, the other line, of course, is I think I got my first introduction to Conan, not actually through Robert E. Howard, who I went on to later, but through the Marvel Comics Roy Thomas incarnations, of course, of the 70s and so on.
Oh, yes, I remember those.
The great stuff there. But it's not just, I say, the Children of Red Peak, which we're going to come back to, but I see also you've got the Armor series, the Battle of North America, a searing portrayal of tank combat following a Sherman tank crew fighting the Axis from North Africa, I should say, to Berlin. I think I might have panicked people there saying the Battle for North America, Sherman tanks. Is this alternate history? But, I mean, that's one of the whole thing. Plus, of course, Our War, which again...
Where there are battles in North America.
Yeah, precisely. A brother and sister become child soldiers fighting on opposite sides of a second American Civil War. Wasn't the first one in 1861 to 1865 good enough then, Craig? What are you doing, predicting history here?
As you can see with my horror and other speculative fiction, I tend to explore my worst fears. And so at the time, I was looking not just at what was going on in the U.S. immediately and what might happen, which was an impeachment, and if enough people in the Senate went along with it, what would that mean? That turned out the conviction didn't happen, but the impeachment happened. But to me, it was all just didn't matter. It was just a catalyst, and whoever was in office at the moment actually kind of didn't matter either. It was. It was a symptom, not the disease. The disease to me was American descent into tribalism over the last 30 years, exploited by media. I mean, there's a buck in this for people for this division, and there's power in it. And so there's going to be more and more division, and rage sells way more than sex does. And so there's America is being kind of forced apart, not just by different interests and not just by an income, a growing income gap, but also because of these different stories of what America is and should be. And without a unifying idea, one story of America, it's really just another multi-ethnic empire that there's not a lot holding it together. And so I found as an American living in Canada, but as an American first, I was extremely alarmed by this development and ended up writing a story about it. What if our worst fears came true? And it wouldn't look like 1861. It would look a lot like Bosnia, rural fighting kind of a city. And it would be a fight in which everybody would fight and nobody would win. And so, it was a dark book to write but I did enjoy writing it. And I got something out there that I think was a good warning.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly the very notion of, you know, siblings becoming opposite sides on the war is heartrending in its own routine. I mean, my campaign, as I say, for ensuring that peace reigns throughout North America is after Jessica graduates, she should be running a presidential ticket for herself for 2024. As you can see, she's already got the mask and she's all set for a dystopian future as it stands. So, you know, all well with that. Jessica, any thoughts from yourself in terms of Craig's tremendous sort of oeuvre?
Yeah. Do you always take your inspiration from, you know, like the climate around you and, you know, the world, or do these ideas just pop in your head? Because I think it sounds very topical, the topic of your book.
Yeah, well, with Our War, certainly. But when I write my self-published fiction, it tends to be, you know, the World War II stuff. It's just fun, man in a hole stories, kind of formulaic, very pulpy. Kind of I follow the dime novel model, purely at trying to entertain people in a short format, and give them a series of these stories. When I write for large publishers like Hachette, tend to write bigger standalone big idea novels. And when I write horror, it has a lot of tropes. It's this big ugly family. I'm always interested in either turning these tropes on their head or examining their consequences. So The Children of Red Peak does both. It looks at a cult from a more realistic point of view, where we see a religious group whose ways may seem alien, but it's really not all that bad. But then something changes, they hear the voice of God offering a deal, and they transform into a horrific cult. A lot of the horror is in how quickly and logically they transform. The novel also looks at what it would be like to survive and being in a cult that destroys itself, and how even though they survived, they never really escaped, and eventually they'll have to go back to Red Peak to find closure. But thematically, I was interested in exploring the idea of how belief is a common trait, but it can run amok. A lot of inspiration came from a reading of the book of Genesis, where God tells Abraham to bring his son Isaac to a mountain and sacrifice him as a burnt offering. Abraham doesn't. At the last minute, God tells him to stop. I thought it'd be interesting to tell that story from Isaac's point of view.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's fascinating in terms of obviously taking the biblical sort of text and adjusting that. Thankfully, the New Testament has got a little bit of a rejoinder to that and says, look, it's okay. There's more love in the world than you actually think, as long as you're sort of aware of that. But you're right, Craig. Of course, there is that challenge that's actually there. And taken literally, that can be one of the most dangerous things at all in terms of people who actually misuse and misquote either scriptural text, whether it's the Bible, whether it's the Quran, any of these things can lead to huge challenges with society.
Well, yeah, I looked at religion as something that is stems from a fundamental human instinct, which is to believe, and it's actually a survival trait for us to be able to believe and imagine and believe in things that aren't there. But like any other human instinct, it can run amok. And especially in the modern day, it's so very much easier to run amok. And when it does run amok, you have, say, religion or a political movement or whatever, something that can produce almost all the good in the world and something that can produce so much of the bad in the world as well. And so I was fascinated by how belief can stem – all of this can stem from belief. And so that's what really attracted to me this thematically. Again, that idea of taking a trope of a cult, turning it on its head, and then examining the consequences of the cult. And so I wanted to show what it'd be like to be in a group like this, where it starts out good, but then descends into madness because of one catalyst, you know, trips them on their slippery slope. And then they end up in a dark place. And then I wanted to examine the consequences. What would it have been like to have survived a group like this? And now it's years later and you're dealing with that trauma.
And the road to Hades is obviously paved with good intentions, to paraphrase the line.
Yeah, it's sort of an unofficial motto in my books, actually. Yeah.
Interesting that New York Times bestselling author Richard Chismer, of course, has quite rightly said of The Children of Red Peak, gripping, thought-provoking, and suspenseful, Craig DeLuise's latest is a master study of darkness and light and the meaning of life. Epic. Although there are those of us, Craig, who would maintain that actually Monty Python actually sold the meaning of life by saying it was 42. But oh no, Douglas Adams, in fact.
Douglas Adams, yeah.
Yeah. Python obviously just had a movie called The Meaning of Life. It's all very strange. I'm looking at other texts. The Alchemists, during the tumultuous Renaissance, two great men resume an old duel to determine which is superior, magic or science. And of course, The Infection War, the first two books in your classic apocalyptic series, newly revised and published. Do you wake up in the morning thinking, today I'm going to write historical fiction, now I'm going to write war fiction, now I'm going to write suspenseful horror, or do the muses come to you from different areas?
Well, I'm a hyper-focusing linear thinker. So yeah, I don't just wake up and say, what do I want to write today? I'll work on this. Yeah, for me, I live and breathe the book I'm writing. And it's because, you know, when you get to a certain point in your career, the good news is you got somewhere and now that opens another door. The bad news is a lot of doors may open all at once and you suddenly find yourself with a lot of opportunity you have to get very quickly. So there's a certain point in your career as a writer where efficiency becomes everything. And so I hyper-focus on a book. I do a ton of research on it. I plot it. I do the character arcs. I write it. And, I'll get these things done, you know, in a very short amount of time. And then I move on to the next thing while it's in editing. And so that's pretty much how I'm working right now. But so I get these things, these pretty big amounts of labor done fairly quickly, but I do a lot of it through, you know, I'm in the shower, I'm picturing a scene, I'm about to fall asleep, I'm picturing a scene, I'm driving the car. I always have a notebook in my back pocket. I always have pens. I'm always writing notes, filling notebooks while I'm dreaming the book. I'm internalizing it so much, the characters, who they are. I know, so that when I start writing, I know exactly who they are. I know exactly where this thing is going. And then I can, and then it just kind of pours out of me at that point.
I've got to say, certainly looking at your website, of course, craiglouis.com, some of the lines that come through are sort of ideal for the next generation of Netflix series, if not indeed motion pictures, if we ever get back to making motion pictures in the way they used to be made again. The Front series, of course, series set in World War II. The paratroopers of three nations must work together to stop a zombie plague. I knew there was something missing with our World War II histories. We just have the zombies.
Of course. Of course. Zombies make everything better. They're like salt.
I'm sure Jessica would say no, that's sweet tea, not zombies.
Yes.
But anyway, over to you, Jessica. Any further thoughts?
Did you grow up always wanting to be a writer, or is this something that kind of came out of nowhere? Because it sounds like you definitely have the mind for it, with carrying notebooks and, you know, it's always in your mind. It seems like you're a very creative person.
Yeah, I've always wanted to be a writer since I was 9 years old. I've always wanted to be creative, and that was when I was reading, and I discovered, you know, Robert E. Howard was sort of my gateway drug to all of this life, and fell in love with the written word and its power, what it could do for you. You know, so I was growing up on a farm outside this small town in New Jersey, and, you know, which was a great place to grow up, but didn't have much of, you know, there wasn't a lot of excitement. And so as a young teenager, novels took me to different places and different experiences. And it was such a powerful awakening for me that it was something I wanted to do for myself. Absolutely. But, you know, it's like being a writer is like being a violinist. Not everybody is a prodigy. That first time you pick up a violin, you sound terrible. You have to practice, right? And it's the same thing with writing. And they discovered with the brains of writers, if you keep doing it, sort of like that Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours, you know, you get good at something. Your brain eventually starts to actually tune towards that one task you've chosen to do extremely well. They found that the brains of writers have altered, similar to the way the brains of, you know, violinists, professional musicians, and athletes have altered around what they have chosen to do. So it's something that you have to keep at. It's not something that it's very difficult to be really good at immediately. It's something that you do have to practice over time and keep writing and always be producing, and you get better and better with each book.
And once again, with the brains, Craig, you know, eating the brains of writers, seeing the brains of writers and so on and so forth. It's a zombie connection that's clearly running through here as a trope.
Writing that. Brains, yeah, they'd be like dessert, I guess, for the zombies. Yeah.
Okay. Robert E. Howard, of course, I mean, from his own routine, had an interesting life and obviously a tragic end from that perspective. You've obviously shared some of your own writing experiences from that point of view. Is it a case of, you know, following that line of writing what you know, writing what interests you, and actually doing the research? Is that a kind of critical aspect to what you would advise any young writers in terms of actually people who are just starting out in the field?
Well, certainly. You know, there are a couple maxims that apply here. One is to write what you know, which doesn't mean if you work in a pen factory, you should write about a pen factory, but you can certainly write about the working class experience because you work in a pen factory. So you understand the relationship, you know, with a boss, you understand that, you know, lots of different things that come from that, stem from that, that can fuel a story that is knowledgeable. The more you do experience, the better you do get at writing, because you just have this kind of this net for your ideas. Otherwise, besides write what you know, the main thing is just to keep writing. People have asked me, like, you know, for advice, you know, because I've I wouldn't know if I'm successful. By my own definition, I am, but that doesn't mean I am objectively.
You
it's
are
really
successful, Craig. You're on the
well. It's not like you are or aren't. It's like we're all successful on a ladder, right? And so it's I'm at this one rung, and other people are a different rung, and other people are much a very high rung. Like Stephen King would be at the highest probably in this game, and. So I would look at, you know, choose what your definition of success is and then pursue that. But as far as what I could tell you how I became quote successful, it's like, it'd be like telling somebody how I fell up the stairs. I mean, it's really, the only way I could boil it down, it would be, you got to keep producing, experience, produce, get it out there, be willing to fail. Understand you are twice the writer you were last year. You're half the writer you're going to be next year. Keep at it. And then trust the X factor. And that X factor is luck. I wrote all through the 90s and tried to get published with no success. In the early noughties, I did okay with some small press books. I finally got published. But then I wrote a book at the right place at the right time, which was my first zombie novel. And there was a big appetite for it. Ebooks were just starting to get big, and small press was starting to get big with on-demand publishing. And I that book exploded in sales and created a subgenre in the zombie genre, and ended up propelling me. One thing ends up leading to another. And so I would just, if there was no guarantee that I ever would have gotten where I've gotten, it was being at the right place at the right time with the right book. So there is a very strong luck factor here, but you have to make your own odds. You have to be there to be able to get that dice roll. And so you have to keep producing.
Exactly. Keep on keeping on. Or indeed, I'm just thinking about surely the ideal route forward now is actually work in a pen factory, use the pens from the pen factory to do your writing about zombies connecting together in terms of religious cult systems. I mean, that's got to be a formula we can actually look to. A little bit of Conan the Barbarian thrown in as well. It's got to be a winner. Maybe
I love genre mashups.
we'll wrap up at present with the line, of course. David Young, Deacon Price, and Bob Harris live with a dark secret. As children, they survived a religious group's horrific last days at the isolated mountain Red Peak. Years later, as adults, the trauma of what they experience never feels far behind. When a fellow survivor commits suicide, they finally reunite and share their stories. Long repressed memories surface, defying understanding and belief. Why did their families go down such a dark road? What really happened on that final night? The answers lie buried at Red Peak, but truth has a price, and escaping a second time may demand the ultimate sacrifice. You want more? Buy The Children of Red Peak. It's Craig DeLuey's latest awesome novel. That's your shameless plug, Craig, you see. I wanted to
thank you so much.
But save it to the whole thing. Jessica, any closing thoughts from yourself?
What are you doing for quarantine to kind of keep yourself positive? Are you still writing? What are you doing?
Well, I work at home anyway, so my day job is 50-50 fiction writing, and then the other half I write in the construction industry. I write for magazines. I have clients who are manufacturers and trade associations. I do a lot of education, and so that keeps me very busy. During quarantine, it was definitely challenging because the kids were home and we were all scared and but I'd also written about pandemics. So I did have everything battened down and everything prepared.
Your children, Craig, were probably turning around and saying, daddy, what have you written about now?
but you know, it's funny, you write fiction that you claim prescience, but really I'm quoting experts. I wish the media, like big newspapers, wouldn't say this author called it, like, and say these scientists called it or these epidemiologists called it, because really they did. But when I saw a city of 11 million people being quarantined in China, I was like, that's it. Okay. I started building up emergency supplies and trying to figure out how we would do we started planning for it then, because it was inevitable it was going to be here once if it was that big in China, because China is not a country that sacrifices any economic growth readily. So for them to quarantine a city like that was a really big deal for them. And it meant the virus was a big deal. But I went through a month of of an anxiety haze, I think, like everybody else, where I just stared at social media and my computer and didn't really do anything. Just tried to keep my head together and took care of my kids. I made them my priority. And then, you know, it's like anything else. The human mind adapts. You just get used to it. And I'm fortunate in that I work at home anyway, so there wasn't a lot of disruption. The kids have ended up going back to school. I feel like every morning I'm sending the canaries to the coal mine. So that makes me nervous, but so far so good.
Yeah,
and
children's four, basically, Craig. I mean, we know that parents are very difficult to bring into. If you can't, I mean, it goes back to Isaac and Abraham. You know, it's a case of, look, it's a tester. You know, it's a tester. Let's just see. Let's see what's out there. Go on that basis. Only kidding. Different line entirely. But Craig, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self today. Whereabouts in the States or in North America are you actually based?
Well, I live in Calgary, which is in Alberta, right above Montana. So I grew up in New Jersey, lived in New York City for a number of years, and then moved here in 2003.
So any intention of ever going south back to the USA again, now they've got a sort of sensible person back in the White House?
Well, it wouldn't be the politics that would bring me back. It's the my kids are here. So as long as they're, you know, I'm raising children here and we have roots. So I'll
stay
be
north
staying.
Of the border. Stay north of that border.
Yeah, and I've come to really, you know, I came here for marriage, but we lived in New York for a couple of years, and you know, and then 9/11 happened, and it was a really crazy time, and we decided we wanted to move out of the city and looked at where we wanted to live, and we said, well, let's go to her country of Canada, and came here, and I found it a welcoming, wonderful culture, and it's just a great place to live. I absolutely love it. The winters last too long for me, but otherwise it's actually just a wonderful place to live. So
well, Craig, it's been awesome.
I may stay.
It's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self today. Again, a reminder, craigdelouis.com is the go-to website. I feel as though we've covered Robert E. Howard. We've actually covered zombies. We've covered, I mean, the construction industry, though. I mean, there's always the danger, I suppose, talking mashups, that you actually did the classic line when you're doing a construction article saying, but Craig, did you really want to actually have the rotating knives and the severed heads in this particular room in an area of the industry?
Well, I write about the lighting industry, but yeah, no lighting humor in my books. No. Many zombies does it take to change a light bulb or anything like that.
That's a step forward there.
Keep those worlds separate.
And just out of interest, in terms of the actual mechanics of writing, are you a word processor man, or are you more a case of, no, I still use my quill pen. After all, I'm in Canada. I want to keep it traditional.
I'm all about efficiency and being able to write as fast as I think. So I'm a plotter, so I plan out the books, but there's always, I'm a pantser, you know, they call it a pantser, writing by the seat of your pants. I'm a pantser when I'm actually writing. It's called the process of discovery. And so while you're writing, you get on a tear. I write 100 words a minute, type 100 words a minute. So I love typing because my brain can connect with what's on the screen a lot faster. But the pen is wonderful for times when you're writing and you want to slow down and you want to really think and create mood and create feeling and just take your time with it. Then the pen is actually, I'll actually switch to that. And I think it's actually a wonderful tool for that. I wish I could write everything in pen and then type it. And then, because I'd have better, it's just a great way to write. It's a really wonderful process, but it's very slow.
I'm sure there'll be an app that'll actually work through that. And I'm glad, Craig, you actually did point out that it's by the seat of your pants, which is Panzer, as opposed to a German tank of the Second World War, which is also Panzer.
Yes. I've written about them too.
But we're going to wrap up with two final questions. First of all, Craig, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been good for
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great meeting you and Jess.
Well, the next critical question, Jessica, is what?
Will you be joining us again?
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to. It's been wonderful.
Craig DeLouis and Jessica Bertus, huge thanks. That's been this week's Author of the Week. Of course, don't forget, it's November the 17th, literally 3 days after Prince Charles's birthday, when you can actually purchase The Children of Red Peak. Presumably, Craig, you didn't want to actually associate the two things.
Pure coincidence.
The next in line to the throne of Great Britain is actually celebrates his birthday 3 days before the release of The Children of Red Peak. Amazing. Available presumably online and through all good bookstores as well, presumably, Craig.
Yes, absolutely. It'll be available everywhere.
Craig DeLuey, we salute you. Take care now.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And Southside Broadcasting. podbean.com.
Well, we have a situation whereby the pandemic continues, and of course we're heading off into our own sort of basis of surviving, etc. But is it accelerating the shift to a cashless society? To address this, we're delighted to welcome two wonderful folk. First of all, the wonderful Amanda LeBrock. How are you, Amanda?
I'm good, thank you.
And of course, Iona Bain. How are you, Iona?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. Iona, let's come to you first as the Young Money blog, etc. What impact do you think this is going to have on our attitudes to cash? Are we going to have that cashless society that many conspiracy theorists say this is what it's all about in the first place?
Well, I think the research from Marcus by Goldman Sachs does show that we are moving towards a society that's certainly dominated by digital payments. So around half of UK adults say they are less likely to use cash due to COVID-19. And a lot of that is tied up in hygiene concerns, which are understandable at the moment. 32% say they feel uncomfortable handling cash because of those hygiene concerns. But also just because we are living in a world now where it is possible to pay for pretty much everything using either a debit card, a contactless card, or even a digital wallet, which I started using recently. And it has been a game changer for my finances. But what I think is also interesting about this research is that it shows half of us do think cash reminds us of the real value of money. So whilst that's the case, I think cash will still have a place in our wallets and in our purses. And there are lots of groups in society that still depend on cash, whether that's the elderly or people living in more rural areas with poor connectivity issues. So I think it's about having a choice. Yes, digital payments are great, but cash, there'll always be a place for it in society, I think.
And Amanda LeBrock, as head of strategy to Marcus by Goldman Sachs, do you think that there's a generational gap here? Do you think that people who are less tech savvy might be a little bit more concerned about this? Or is it a case of it's inevitable, we're heading there?
Our research absolutely supported that there is a divide between the generations. What was super interesting is that we actually looked across a number of different demographics, so household income, region, gender. But it was only really age where our attitudes varied towards cash. So the younger generations are 2.5 times more likely to believe that you shouldn't need to carry a cash in this day and age. But then at the same time, as Iona said, our survey still said that 3 in 10 do worry if they don't have cash on them. So I think as we roll through the generations, the level of digital adoption will continue to increase. But I think it's absolutely about choice. And I think that cash will still play a role in everyone's lives.
The report, of course, is Exploration of Worth. Where can people actually find details about this and more online, Amanda?
Well, if you can visit the Marcus website at marcus.co.uk/worth, you will see the full report there, and it's well worth a read.
Amanda LeBrock, head of strategy at Marcus by Goldman Sachs. And of course, Iona Bain from the awesomely wonderful The Young Money blog. Huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and be well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.